Eliza said, pointing over the well-wishers and past them. The one with a strong horizontal limb, like a soldier's rifle held at his shoulder. That is the tree where convicts are hanged, is it not?
Eliza, please, Aunt Gertrude pleaded. You are only making it worse.
The turn around the green was completed, and the carriage headed back along South Street. The view was of white houses now, dainty and neat, with shutters thrown wide to let in the late morning sunshine. A great furred calico cat, as big as a raccoon, with an orange patch over one green eye and a black one over the other, sat atop a fence post and cleaned its paws lazily as she watched Eliza's carriage float by.
"Oh, I do so love a long-haired cat," Aunt Gertrude said, staring at the placid beast. "They are as twice as warm as a muff on a winter day. They can be a bit ratty, though. But that fine puss is as well-groomed as a princess. Someone loves her."
"Mama tried for years to keep cats at the pastures," Eliza answered. "But the foxes killed them all. I don't think they were even eating them. I think they just killed them to spite Mama."
"You cannot blame Mrs. Schuyler for this, Eliza. You know she wants what's best for you."
"Does she? She offers me for sale to the highest bidder, and then has not even the courtesy of showing up to see the final results of the auction.
It is a 3-day journey from Albany under the best of circumstances, and with the wetness this spring, no doubt the route is even slower than ever. And I have heard reports of British raiders, too, making so bold as to attack even guarded mail coaches. Would you really want your mother to risk her life just to see you exchange a few words before a minister?"
"I think she ought to be here to see what she has wrought. Papa, too. It is the least they could do."
"Hush now. We're here."
The carriage had pulled up before a large white house, which, if truth be told, looked like every other house in Morristown and every other house in New Jersey, save that it was a little larger than most, with broader windows and a more ornate pediment over the door. Where once Eliza had delighted in the little touches that made each five-bay house a unique expression of its owner's taste, now she saw them as minute variations on a single repetitive theme. And that theme was conform or be cast out. And look at her. After all her talk of being her own woman, forging her own path, she was letting herself be led along like a sheep to be sheared and sheared again and again until, at last, it gives no wool, and instead of having its hair cut, its throat is cut instead, and it winds up in a stew pot. Aunt Gertrude alighted from the carriage with the footman's aid, and now held her hand up to Eliza.
"Come, dear."
"No."
"Eliza, please. It is the way things must be."
"No," Eliza repeated. "I will not hand myself over to my own doom."
"Then you hand your family over to their doom," Aunt Gertrude said. "Are you so selfish that you would sacrifice your papa and mama and brothers and sisters so that you don't have to marry a man you don't love? Do you think a better man will take you after word of the scandal gets out?
Are they so craven that they would sell their daughter? I tell you, I will not do it."
"Eliza!" another voice called then. "Eliza, wait!"
Eliza turned. She saw another carriage farther up the lane, wooden-sided and covered with mud, as if it had traveled some great distance. Its door opened, and a blue-jacketed figure was tumbling out of it so clumsily that the carriage rocked like a dinghy in the wake of a whale ship. The fellow stumbled to the ground and nearly fell, his three-cornered hat tumbling off his head and exposing a shock of russet-colored hair.
It cannot be,"
Eliza breathed. The ginger-haired figure looked up at her, and there were the blue eyes that melted her heart.
Eliza, wait. I'm here.
Alex, Eliza said, afraid to believe it. Still, she was standing up, no, scrambling up and pushing aside her aunt's hand and the footman's and forcing her bustled hips through the narrow door of the carriage so quickly that she heard fabric tear. She pushed herself all the way through and hopped down onto the flagstone bricks of the Livingstons' front walk.
Alex, she said, is it really you?
His face was flushed, and he seemed somewhat thinner. He handled his right arm gingerly, as though it pained him. His hands in hers were so hot that she could feel them through his gloves and hers.
It's me, he said. I'm here. You don't have to marry him. You have to... That is...
He sank somewhat gingerly to one knee.
Elizabeth Schuyler, my darling Eliza, my one and only Betsy, will you marry me?
When Alex knelt, a second pair of figures came into her view, emerging from the carriage that had carried him. Her parents. General and Mrs. Schuyler looking on with grim but determined smiles on their faces. Eliza found her mother's eyes. Her mother looked back steadily, then nodded. Eliza looked down at Alex, who stared back at her adoringly, nervously, triumphantly. She opened her mouth to answer him, but no words came out.
35. Here comes the groom. The Cochrane residence, Morristown, New Jersey, April, 1780.
But how did you... I mean, you just disappeared, and then your horse was found with blood, and I wrote, and no one answered, and Governor Livingston was just so... so...
It's fine, Eliza. It's fine.
Alex knelt on the carpet and stroked Eliza's hand, where she lay on the sofa in Aunt Gertrude's parlor.
I'm here now. I'll explain everything, or, well, your mother will, because I'm afraid I don't remember much.
You don't remember? Eliza asked, frowning. I don't understand.
Catherine Schuyler's round face slipped into her daughter's viewpoint.
Oh, Eliza, this poor boy was so delirious when he arrived at the pastures that he had no idea where he was. In truth, I have no idea how he found us. It must have been God's will that he arrive.
You rode all the way to Albany and back. In 7 days.
4 days, really, Mrs. Schuyler answered. 3 of those days were spent to bed, where he should still be, if you ask me.
I am quite recovered, Mrs. Schuyler, all due to your good care.
You do look rather peaked, Eliza said. But please tell me what happened. Why did you run off? And how came you to be so ill that you were 3 days bedridden at my parents' house?
Alex shrugged and moved from the carpet to a nearby chair, though never letting go of Eliza's hand.
I knew that the only way you would break off the engagement to Colonel Livingston was with your parents' permission. And I knew that the only way they would grant that permission was if they were told clearly and without the tact that a feminine correspondent would undoubtedly put into a letter exactly what kind of scoundrel he was. And so I requisitioned a horse from the mail coach and made my way there. It was a rainy day, as you recall, and I had already been some 6 hours on horseback during the journey from Amboy and awake for some 18 hours, so I was rather susceptible to the effects of damp and fatigue.
And then you were ambushed by those British dragoons.
As I said, it is a wonder you made it to us at all,
interjected Mrs. Schuyler once more.
Ambushed! Cried Eliza.
Even if Alex were at liberty to divulge the evidence of treason he had uncovered regarding General Arnold and Major André, he couldn't think of the words to describe it. He wasn't entirely convinced that he hadn't dreamed up the whole thing.
"Your father has handled it," he said gently. Suffice to say that the culprits will be brought to justice, and history will remember them in infamy.
Are you hurt? Eliza said. It seemed to me that you were favoring your arm earlier.
Just a scratch, Alex said, releasing Eliza's hand just long enough to rub his wound gingerly, then taking it up again. The scab pulled when he lifted it, but the muscle beneath was uninjured. In a week or two, he would likely not even remember the cut. The attack itself was a blur, too, lost behind a wall of fatigue and fever.
So that was your blood on your horse's saddle. But how came it to arrive at the coach station without you?
It was spooked by the gunshots and made its way home to the station on its own. I was able to catch one of my assailant's horses. I rode as far as the Slote House coach station and po that, and on up to Albany.
And you slept not a wink during the entire journey? Eliza asked incredulously.
Not in a bed, Alex said, though there were times I'm sure I dozed on horseback.
By the time he got to us, Mrs. Schuyler said here, he barely knew his own name or why he had come. I tell you, he was raving so badly that I thought the fever had gone to his brain and we would not have him back. But it seems to have been mostly the effects of 3 days without sleep and little food, a nagging wound, and a terrible chill.
They tell me I slept for 2 days, Alex confessed sheepishly. I must apologize for that, my dear Eliza.
Oh, nonsense, Eliza said, stroking his hand. I can't believe you risked your life for me.
I would risk it 1,000 times more to win your heart.
Mrs. Schuyler cleared her throat self-consciously. While he slept, your Aunt Cochrane's note came. But I confess that your father and I could not distinguish between the jitters of a reluctant bride and the malfeasance of a roué.
Certainly we had heard nothing suggesting that Colonel Livingston's character was anything less than that of a gentleman, or we would have never consented to the marriage.
Alex watched as Mrs. Schuyler fixed her daughter in the eye with almost desperate earnestness. I do hope you believe that, daughter. Henry was always a weak boy, Eliza said in a measured voice, not forgiving but not condemning either. But never a roué, as you say. I gather that his time in the army has not had the character-strengthening effect it has on so many of our soldiers. But you could not have known that. He has been stationed in Connecticut and coastal Massachusetts, far from Albany, let alone New Jersey or Philadelphia.
It was not exoneration, but Mrs. Schuyler seemed content with that.
We thought to write you, but then Colonel Hamilton awakened and was able to give us a fuller accounting, and we were convinced that it was necessary that we travel here in person to stop the marriage. Colonel Hamilton insisted on accompanying us, but the doctor said he wasn't well enough. We managed to keep him in bed one more day, but then he said he would return without us, so your father commissioned a carriage and we came together. We had to hope that your Aunt Cochrane was able to delay the marriage until word came from us or we arrived ourselves.
Aunt Gertrude was remarkable, Eliza said. I suspect Governor Livingston will never set foot in a house occupied by her ever again.
Alex looked over at Mrs. Cochrane, twirling the small vial of smelling salts she had used to revive Eliza in the fingers of one hand. She caught his eye and winked. Just then, the front door clicked open, and a moment later General Schuyler stomped into the parlor.
"It is done," he said, removing his hat and coat, then handing it to a servant in the hall. He shut the door behind him and took a seat on a chair close to his wife. "I have persuaded Governor and Colonel Livingston to release you from your engagement and to keep the entire matter strictly en famille. In exchange, Colonel Livingston will not be brought before a court-martial for callously and carelessly jeopardizing the lives of 7 Continental soldiers in moving them from their infirmary so that he could throw a party,
and of course his most reprehensible and disgusting actions against a lady shall remain known only to the injured party and her family.
He looked at his daughter with equal parts tenderness and anger.
Though I would prefer to shoot him myself. At least some manner of justice has been done. A scoundrel like that will seek out his own justice eventually,
Alex said with disgust.
Although I, too, wish I could be the one to mete it out. It is behind us now,
General Schuyler said,
and a much brighter future lies ahead. That is, if Eliza will still have you,
he added with a wink at his daughter. What? Eliza said.
There was a question on the table, General Schuyler said, that Colonel Hamilton put to you before you so rudely fainted into his arms.
Oh, I would not call it rude, Mrs. Schuyler admonished her husband. I would call it charming.
Well, charming or rude, she shouldn't leave the poor boy hanging.
General Schuyler managed to chuckle.
The poor boy agrees,
Alex chimed in, looking at Eliza hopefully. What? Eliza stuttered again. I mean... She looked nervously at her parents, but mostly her mother. Can I? You seemed so against it before.
There are families whose greatness lies in their past and in their legacies, Mrs. Schuyler answered. That is a quality much to be admired, for tradition is what binds us as a society. But there are some families, like some nations, whose greatness is a future development, and that quality, though harder to discern than the prestige of manor houses and coats of arms and titles of rank and office, is no less valuable if indeed not more so.
General Schuyler put his arm around his wife and drew her near.
What Mrs. Schuyler is saying, General Schuyler added, is that it is the Schuylers who would be honored by a union with so brilliant and noble a personage as Colonel Hamilton.
So I can marry him, Eliza said, her eyes flitting between her parents and Alex. I can say yes.
You had better, Mrs. Schuyler said, or I shall never forgive you.
Eliza turned to Alex. Alex felt his body fall away from him. The only thing that kept him rooted to earth was his hand in Eliza's.
Then, yes, Eliza exclaimed. Yes, yes, and yes, I will marry you. Yes, yes, yes.
36. Poor Man's Wife. The Cochrane Garden, Morristown, New Jersey, August, 1780. For his entire lifetime, Alex had been dragging his past behind him like a heavy chain. He was an open man with no secrets to hide. Yet he had all the insecurities of an outsider. From his melancholy youth, he was ever needy to earn a foothold in respectable society. Whether by the zest in his pen or the zing of a bullet past his ear, he wanted to make a difference in the new world by his own merit. It was true, he had hitched his horse to General Washington's wagon with roaring success, and was now on the verge of ascending into polite society by becoming one of the Schuyler family. And yet, as much as thriving as the right-hand man to General Washington and becoming the son-in-law to General Schuyler thrilled him, there were always the nagging doubts from the wounds of his childhood. Would people regard him as marrying into the Schuyler family only to access their wealth? How could Eliza Schuyler possibly believe he could provide for her as a husband? He had written her reams and reams of letters, as well as a poem that she kept folded in a locket around her neck. Her letters were full of love and anticipation, matching his for enthusiasm and tenderness. He was the luckiest man in the world. Their wedding was set for December, when there would be the winter lull in fighting, and he would be able to take a few weeks off for the ceremony and the honeymoon. But it was now August, and while he did not doubt her love for him, he wanted to make certain she knew what she was getting into. Taking a few days' leave to be able to see his beloved, he returned to Morristown, his heart in his hands. Eliza dug her hands into the dark earth, happy to be out in the sunshine of Aunt Gertrude's vegetable garden on this hot summer day. Alex had returned from the battlefront unexpectedly that morning and just escorted her home from church. While checking the garden for any hint of greenery to add to Aunt Gertrude's luncheon table, she found small green squashes already gone to seed. "Alex, is there anything more beautiful than dropping a seed in the earth and then waiting for it to become something perfectly useful? These tiny seeds will be cucumbers by next midsummer, sitting in the middle of Aunt Gertrude's table as finger sandwiches. How perfectly practical it must be to be a farmer's wife." Alex circled the flagstone border that enclosed the garden for the third time. It was not often that he could manage a visit, but it appeared there was a certain urgency to this one. He looked like a man who had something to get off his chest, and she'd unintentionally led him right to it with her innocent question. "How practical must it be, you ask, to be a farmer's wife, Betsy?" Alex stopped in his circle and approached her straight on. "Rather, the question, I should think, is how practical must one be to be a farmer's wife? Or a poor man's wife? How practical must one be to forget about beautiful dresses and elegant dinners and a house full of servants to prepare it all at a moment's notice? How practical does a poor man's wife have to be content with a book by candlelight instead of a night at the opera? How practical to watch your hands grow rough with gardening and milking and churning and all the work that is to be done just to make it from one dawn to the next?"
Eliza looked at Alex. Ah, so that was his worry. He had said as much in his lovely letters. She saw the dread in his face and wanted to make it disappear. "But my darling, I merely meant I love to garden, and I love to sew. I meant nothing more than that. What is it, dearest? What are you trying to tell me?"
"I fear, Betsy, that our love, deep as it is not enough to nurture a lifelong marriage. Marriage is in many ways a business partnership, and I fear you are getting the rough end of the deal by marrying me." Alex ran his hands through his hair and opened his palms. "I confess I have not been as brilliant in managing my own monetary affairs as I have been in managing the affairs of state. Money and land never seemed to matter to me until now. But now there is you and our future children to consider. I must take care of you in the best way I know how. And I do not know that I am good enough."
Eliza put down her trowel and brushed off her hands. She'd left her bonnet inside, and her face had quickly pinked up under the sun. She opened her arms to him. "Come here to me, Alex. I shall show you what I care about." Alex found he couldn't look her in the eye.
"Oh, my pretty damsel. When I think of the match you could have made, ugh, and here you have chosen me, one who has so little to offer. If happiness were all that it took to make a thing such as marriage work, we would be set for life. But how can you be sure that ours will not turn into one of those tragic unions that unhappy couples share?"
Eliza laughed. "Perhaps you forget I was raised by a thrifty Dutch woman who managed an entire household while raising a large brood of children. Surely there is something of practical value in all of that."
"You make light of it today, but I entreat you. Consider me decades from now. Will you be as satisfied then as you are at this moment with being a poor man's wife?"
"Silly man. I know the man I am marrying is destined for great things.
as the many remarkable things he has done thus far have brought him to such a high point already. Mark my words, Alex. You are a man whose future lies before him for all to marvel at one day. And you, Colonel Hamilton, are mine. And I am yours always. He scooped her into his arms once again, his doubts quelled.
I shall never be worthy of you, my angel, he said. I know I shall disappoint you in a thousand ways before our time on Earth is through. But I hope that you will always see the good in me, and know that this unworthy heart of mine will always be yours, no matter what obstacles or failures I bring to your life.
Eliza pulled away and looked him right in the eye.
I know you, Alex. I know you, and I love you. And I shall always love you, come what may. I shall be yours, always.
37. Wedding March. The Schuyler Mansion, also known as the Pastures, Albany, New York, December 14th, 1780. At long last, it was time for the wedding. Life being life and war being war, the heady romance of the proposal endured a 9 months interregnum before it was consummated at the Pastures in Albany. For one thing, Eliza wanted to be married as far from the debacle of Morristown as possible. Wanted only to remember Morristown as the place where she had fallen in love with Alex, and not where she had almost lost him and herself. For another, it was the place where Alex had had his command of the 3rd New Jersey abruptly mooted when General Clinton of the British Army stepped up his invasion of Charleston, which after a 6 week siege had fallen in mid-May. It was altogether a disastrous turn of events, one that left General Washington scrambling to recover and unable to part with his most trusted aide. The Benedict Arnold affair proved even more tumultuous. General Arnold was one of the brightest stars in the Continental Army, who had once served with General Schuyler. Thanks in part to Alex's discovery of his correspondence with Major Andre, the Continental Army was able to foil Arnold's plan to hand the fort at West Point over to the British. General Arnold himself managed to escape, but Major Andre had been caught and imprisoned. Though Eliza remembered him fondly as the dashing swain who had danced with her on the very night she met her future husband, Alex realized there had been something sneaky about him that night they bumped into him in Morristown at the bonfire. Though General Arnold had initiated the plan, and John Andre was merely the officer he managed to contact, everyone on both sides of the conflict thought Major Andre one of the most honorable men in either army. Yet the law was clear, and General Washington's position inflexible. Though Alex himself asked General Washington for clemency, on October 2nd, the dashing young officer was hanged for espionage behind enemy lines. The death shook Eliza deeply, and it was some weeks before she felt ready to move forward with, as she said, the rest of my life. But at last there was a lull in Alex's duties, and by the end of November he was able to escape north to the pastures. The wedding was on for December 14th at noon. Catherine Schuyler stood in front of her looking-glass, rocking her enormous belly. She was visibly pregnant for the 12th time in her lifetime and decidedly cranky. But today at noon she would paint a smile on her face and play hostess at the Schuyler family's grand wedding feast for her second eldest daughter, Eliza. A second glance in the mirror did little to calm her nerves. "I look like a stout Dutch milkmaid," she groused. As the noontime wedding hour approached, there was nothing for it but to lift her chin high and wear a dazzling shawl. She chose a green and burgundy velvet piece, patterned with feathers that spread across her shoulders and ended in gold-threaded tassels that dropped below her hips. Once a striking dark-haired beauty with a long, elegant neck, she could hardly remember the pert figure she had been so careless with. But the vanity created by the overheated praise from her groom on their wedding night had stuck with her forever. But as the years passed in a lifetime spent raising her large brood, Mrs. Schuyler had developed a habit of rocking herself to generate a moment of peace. Now she caught occasional murmurs of being called the rocking horse by her children, and routinely found her husband disappearing into his study each evening after dinner. Nevertheless, for today, Eliza's special day, Catherine Schuyler would make every effort to be gracious. It was to be a small family wedding in the Schuyler home, as was the Dutch custom of the day. Of course, there was nothing small about the Pastures or the extended Schuyler clan, and with the Schuylers there were always songs to be sung and games to be played inside and out. The general recruited Mr. Vincent to ferry guests back and forth over the ice-packed Hudson in an open sleigh rigged out with the jangling bells of two liveried horses. As the noonday sun glanced off the snow on that cold December 14th, and the parlor began to fill up with first cousins, distant relatives, and friends, a Bach sonata for flute and harpsichord signaled the wedding was about to get underway. The southeast parlor, being the grandest in the house, was chosen, wherein were gathered Angelica and John Church, and Peggy and Stephen Van Rensselaer, and Philip Jr. and the younger Schuyler siblings, along with the requisite Schuyler, Van Cortlandt, and Van Rensselaer kin. Anticipating the bride's entrance, all conversation came to an abrupt halt as guests took their places on either side of the great hall. The family sat in several tiers of chairs, exquisitely yet soberly dressed, except for Angelica, who could not resist a crimson gown. Waiting in the vestibule for General Schuyler to walk their daughter into the room, Catherine Schuyler crossed her shawl over her large belly and began to rock herself. Not lost on her was the irony of the bride coming down the aisle on the arm of her father. The quaint concept that a woman is under the primary care of her father until she is given over to the keeping of another man. Well, her first daughter Angelica's ship had already sailed on that passage. So Mrs. Schuyler intended to relish every moment of this, her second daughter's most elaborate affair. Although, in hindsight, as practical Eliza had reminded her mother after the wedding costs began to mount up, perhaps Angelica had done the financially strapped Schuylers a considerable favor. But enough about her mother. For as much as this was Mrs. Schuyler's triumph, it was Eliza's day. And on this very special day, Eliza remained true to herself to the last. Entering the grand foyer to strains of Bach and heads tilting with oohs and ahs, she represented the picture of modesty and grace in a simple dress of ivory, fitted but without a corset, with thick petticoats to give it shape, but nothing so cumbersome or affected as a bustle or train. A thin silver diadem circled her hair, from which hung the palest veil, set with freshwater pearls. Aunt Gertrude's borrowed cameo provided the finishing touch. Altogether, the first glimpse of his bride, which should have come as no surprise to Alex, standing there looking so lean and handsome himself, nearly brought him to his knees. Of course, a young groom always tries to look his best, but Alex was particularly dashing in his blue and buff uniform with the gold epaulettes and the green ribbon of an aide-de-camp. He had known all along exactly what he would wear, the same stiff number he'd chosen to sit for his portrait by Charles Wilson Peel shortly after he joined General Washington's staff. The yellow buttons gleamed on his uniform, and breeches were as brilliantly white as the legs of a hawk. A single curled lock of his ginger hair had escaped the ribbon that held it back and fell rakishly beside his eyes. But behind that confident facade, even on what should have been the happiest day of his life, there was a sadness he could not name. In contrast to his bride's enormous tribe, there was no one there to represent his own, despite his best entreaties. Yes, he had sent a written invitation to his estranged brother in St. Nevis to come meet his black-eyed beauty, and he had pressed hard for his father to come to America from the Grenadines, but neither of them had written him back. Indeed, no one from his remaining family would ever meet any of the Schuylers. For Alex to be enveloped into one of New York State's Blue Ribbon families helped put to bed a lifetime of doubts and depression about his own dubious birthright. Eliza fretted for her fiancé, but he seemed resolute. "You are the only family I need," he'd told her. And now the moment had arrived. The minister began the ceremony with the traditional question for Eliza's parents. "Do you, General and Mrs. Schuyler, give your blessing to these two and promise them your continued love and support?"
"We do," said the Schuylers,
"with God's help." An amen chorus from their huge clan echoed their pledge. Then the minister turned to Alex. There was no one beside him. "And who stands up for you, sir?" There was an awkward silence as the guests looked around the room for the bridegroom's supporters. Finally, an unpretentious voice announced itself from the edge of the room. "I do, sir." Stephen Van Rensselaer slipped through the guests and stepped up right behind Alex. Peggy's hand went to her throat, her eyes brimming with love for a man whose words always seemed to come at the perfectly timed moment. The familiar words of the Dutch Reformed marriage ceremony stumbled slowly out of Stephen's mouth. "I give my blessing and promise my continued love and support." "As do I."
Lieutenant Colonel James McHenry, Alex's fellow aide-de-camp, cut smartly through the guests to take up his post beside Stephen.
"And I as well," said John Church, his voice booming from the other side of the hall. The minister raised his eyebrows, patiently waiting for the coda to their pledge. "With God's help," said the three in perfect unison.
"Well done," whispered Angelica to her very own new husband.
Even she couldn't help but be moved. The minister covered the bridal couple's clasped hands with his own and called for the exchange of the vows. In deference to his future in-laws, Alex had gone along with the conventional vows of the Schuyler's church. But when it came to writing his personal vows, the scrivener in him came to the fore. Alex listened intently as Eliza recited the familiar vows.
"I shall love you and give myself up for you, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up."
The minister nodded for Alex to repeat the words. He began true enough. "I shall love you and give myself up for you as Christ loved the church and gave himself up." Then Alex looked into Eliza's shining eyes and added a twist of his own. "And I shall serve you with tenderness and respect and encourage you to develop the gifts that God has given you." Eliza's eyes were so fastened on Alex that it was as if the words came directly from his mind to hers. The minister stood between the two of them with a perplexed look on his face. He drew in a deep breath and looked out over the affectionate expressions on the guests' faces. He must have decided the groom's choice of words would more than suffice. "Therefore," the minister intoned, "what God has joined together, let no man tear asunder. By the authority invested in me under God and state, I now pronounce you Alexander and Elizabeth, husband and wife." Eliza beamed at Alex, who exhaled heartily. "You may now kiss the bride, Alexander." Eliza fairly flew into Alex's arms, and they kissed so sweetly and for so long that it drew cheers all around. General Schuyler tossed his head back and roared with the gusto of a contented man. He marched across the entrance hall, eager to congratulate the newlyweds with a hearty handshake for his son-in-law and a kiss on the cheek for his daughter.
"Eliza, my sweet girl, you have chosen well."
The general rubbed his hands together and shouted to the musicians to play on.
"Let's liven things up a bit around here."
They kicked off with a boisterous old English wassailing song.
"That's it, boys! Now that's the spirit!"
Alex grabbed his beautiful bride for a reel that was more of a jog, and the house was suddenly full of life and laughter, music and food, children and dogs. Catherine Schuyler stood in the middle of her crowded parlor, rocking herself, surrounded by all the joys such a large, happy family had brought her. Behind her, in a swirl of activity, the servants were bringing out the largest quantity of foods in the best manner the Schuylers could afford. Throughout the day and well into the evening, General Schuyler's valet, Roger, presided over the busy kitchen staff, hard at work doling out clam chowder, stewed oysters, roasted pig, venison, potatoes, baked rye bread, Indian corn bread, and pumpkin casserole. Trays of nut meats and candy dotted the parlor. Coffee and tankards of spiced hard cider were set up on fine linens in the library. Even Aunt Gertrude's Morristown cook had been put to service to bake the wedding cake, a thick, rich, spiced fruit cake made heavy with alcohol and nuts. A round table covered in a beautiful damask cloth was carried into the great hall for the ceremonial cutting of the cake. As was the custom, the cook had baked a piece of nutmeg inside. Whoever received the slice with the nutmeg was supposed to be the next to marry. Catherine Schuyler nearly fainted when it turned out to be Peggy.
38. Happiest they've ever been. Honeymoon Suite, Albany, New York, December 1780. The large gabled mansion on the Hudson seemed eerily quiet after such a long, raucous day of celebration. The last of the guests had gone, and the pastor's kitchen had been returned to its everyday readiness. Dot banked the hearths high and headed off to sleep with a well-deserved hot toddy. By midnight, every room in the house was dark, except for the firelight coming from the secluded guest bedchamber at the top of the stairs. Covered from neck to knee in a ruffled white linen nightshirt, Alex stood beside the canopied four-poster bed, waiting impatiently for his bride to join him. On the other side of the bathchamber door, Eliza passed the end of a fresh candle over the wall sconce's flame to soften the wax. Steadying her nerves as she waited for the slow dripping to begin, she pressed the pliant base of the warmed candle into the candelabrum and held it in place until the wax hardened. She ran the candle's wick through the flame of the sconce and saw her reflection alight in the mirror above the wash basin. She liked how her white satin nightgown created a soft sheen against her skin. But something was still amiss. She reached behind her head to tug the pearl-handled barrette from her hair and let her thick, dark curls fall loose around her shoulders.
"Ah, that's it. I'm ready now."
Eliza opened the door to the bedroom and went to meet her husband. She stepped lightly toward the edge of the bed and kissed Alex full on the lips for the second time this night, frank and tender all at once. As gently and as slowly as he could, while feeling more impatient than he had ever been in his life, Alex took the candelabrum out of her hand and set it on the mantelpiece over the crackling fire. Eliza stood in front of the hearth, luxuriating in the heat against her nightgown. The modest girl was not so modest anymore. Cupping her chin gently in his hands, Alex bent forward to kiss her and inhaled her sweet scent. In an effort to slow himself down, he reached for her hand and took one step back for a good long look at his new bride, from head to toe.
"Turn around, my angel," he managed to say. "Let me see you in the firelight."
Eliza pivoted in a dainty circle, excruciatingly slow. When she came back around, her dark eyes sparkled and a knowing smile played over her lips. She ran her fingertip down his freshly shaven cheek, play-acting the role of a saucy little charmer. "Although I am inexperienced, Alex, I am not naive. But tell me true, do you love me?"
Bouncing on the balls of his feet like a besotted schoolboy, Alex crossed both hands over his heart. "More than any man has ever loved."
The dim light flickered across Eliza's shoulders, and Alex felt his blood rise tight under his skin. It was time for this soldier to rally.
"Indeed, the truth is, Mrs. Hamilton, you take my breath away. Whatever shall we do about it?"
Unbuttoning her white satin gown, Eliza let it drop to her feet. Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton stood next to her husband as he skimmed rocks across the pasture's frozen duck pond. A nearby flock of geese rose from the river bank and squawked at the two of them, switching directions in midair at the sound of Alex's sliding another rock across the ice. She dug her gloved hands into her hips and turned her pretty face toward the afternoon sun. "They must think I'm going to bake them into a pie." Alex laughed as the birds disappeared in noisy protest. Eliza had never seen Alex quite so happy and relaxed. She shook her head and laughed at the incongruity of it all. Imagine, General Washington's famous aide-de-camp taking the time to stop and admire the birds. "One day, Alex, when you tire of being a soldier, we will spend all of our days just like this, watching birds and taking in the sun, surrounded by children of our own. You'd like that, wouldn't you, my love?"
"Eliza, you and the pastors have already taken a perfectly fine soldier and turned him into a lovesick pup. And at this moment, on this very day, there's nothing and nowhere I would rather be."
A week into their honeymoon, Alex had confided to his bride that this was his first few days off in 5 years. As General Washington's right-hand man, Alex was always at the general's beck and call, expected to be ready to write or ride at a moment's notice. Yet here at the pastures he was well away from his work-obsessed life. His days were tasked only with leisurely horseback rides and pulling his boots off by the fire, with Eliza reading at his side or challenging him to a shrewd game of backgammon. Surrounded by family for the first time in his life, he basked in the healthy glow of his wife and the entire Schuyler clan. As Alex and Eliza spent the last few blissful days of their honeymoon, traipsing through the snowy woods or adventuring out on that long-awaited open sleigh for a ride through the streets of Albany with loyal Hector out in front, their future stretched before them with all the hope and promise a new country had to offer. And at last, the lonely young man who belonged to no one finally belonged to someone forever. And the practical girl, who would not settle for less than a love story for the ages, found the lifelong romance she had yearned for all her life.
This is Cassandra Campbell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Alex and Eliza, A Love Story, by Melissa de la Cruz. This program was directed by Danny Campbell. Executive producer, Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2017 by Melissa De La Cruz. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.